Deva Mitra, in case you've not encountered me before. And I'm going to be talking to you this evening about Amitabha. Actually, it's not that long ago since I gave a talk in this very place, on a Monday night class, about Amitabha. So I'm going to make sure that I don't repeat myself too much this evening. I probably won't, but you never know, do you? Yes, I'm just looking around the shrine room to try and work out who's got the glow and who hasn't. I don't think I have, but yes, probably some of you do have it, the post-retreat glow. So before I delve into sublime matters, I thought I'd just recount something that happened to me in the course of the past week, which you probably think, what on earth has this got to do with Amitabha? And it's a good question, actually, but I'm going to tell you anyway. As quite a lot of you know, 2.5 years ago, I was diagnosed with stage 3 cancer, prostate cancer. And so that means that every 6 months, I have to go to Barts Hospital for my latest review to see whether or not the cancer has recurred. I've been through all the usual treatments, you know, chemotherapy, radiotherapy. I'm still on what's called hormone therapy, and will be so for quite a while yet. But anyway, so I went to Barts on Thursday to see my oncologist, who's a very nice woman, very pleasant woman, always bright and breezy, always very, very friendly. And I went into her consulting room, and she told me straight away that my cancer marker is still at zero, which is obviously good news for me. It means I've got another 6 months' grace, which might extend further. We just never know with cancer. But it's an interesting position to be in, because with cancer, or a life-threatening disease like cancer, you're always slightly on the edge. I don't mean in an unpleasant way, although some people might experience it in that way, but you know, it sort of brings you to the edge of existence in a certain sort of sense. Every time one of my reviews is due, I become just that little bit more aware of my own impermanence. So, because you never quite know what you're going to hear when you walk in through that door. And there's always surprises, whether it's a pleasant surprise or otherwise. But anyway, I went in on this occasion, and she told me that yes, my cancer marker's still at zero. And then before I knew it, she started firing off a whole string of questions, all kind of routine questions. And I'd forgotten that this was part of the routine. I was in a rather not very sort of fully alert state. Anyway, so she started asking these questions. Bowels, fine. Waterworks, okay. Erections. And, you know, it's like, yes, I should warn you, men, that one of the hazards of being a prostate cancer patient is from time to time you're asked this erection question. I've been asked this question a number of times. By prostate cancer nurses, by registrar oncologists, and by my, well, actually, it was the first time by my consultant. But every time I'm asked, I'm caught off guard. I wasn't expecting it. I certainly wasn't expecting it on this occasion, because I hadn't been asked for ages, though. Thank goodness they've gotten my erections. But, you know, frequently I find myself being asked, how's your erectile function? Or, you know, are you able to have an erection? And as direct as that, so out it came again, erections. So I was a bit nonplussed, because I'm not frankly preoccupied with this particular aspect of male experience. And to be perfectly honest, I couldn't remember. So I sort of tried to work it out. So I said, rarely. Would you like some help with that? So, you know, what is a man to say? I can't remember what happened next. I said, that's right. I said, look, I'm 71 now. I said, oh, age doesn't matter. And all this in a tone of deepest concern. It's really rather touching. But anyway, finally, after she said that, said, look, really, I'm not bothered. And then we changed the topic. But she slipped this question in so neatly, so very impressively. I mean, I was really, really, one cannot but admire the skill. I was left a bit like a goalkeeper who's just been sent the wrong way by a striker. You know, they score a goal through your legs or something, or something like that. And yes, slightly nonplussed. Now, this was problematic for me because there was something I wanted to talk to her about. I forgot about it. which actually is symptomatic of the issue, which is that I become increasingly aware of my diminishing mental acuity. And I become this increasingly, I become aware especially of this when I'm giving talks. I mean, I gave a talk here on Wednesday evening to the regulars half, the beginners, and I knew exactly what I wanted to say. And I got into the shrine room downstairs, and I gave a totally different talk. Now, it wasn't, well, not totally different, but it was so disjointed. It wasn't quite the sort of talk that I'd intended to give. And I found myself sort of remembering that I'd forgotten something, having to go back to it, and that sort of thing. Fortunately, Pranya Manas, who was a supporting order member with me on that occasion, said it was a really good talk, and it seemed to go down very well. But I was acutely aware of the fact that this is taking place, that my mental acuity is diminishing, and it's diminished a lot, I would say, over the last couple of months or so. So I wanted to talk to her about that, but I forgot. But I did remember the next morning, and so I found a prostate cancer nurse who mercifully didn't mention erections or ask me about them. But I told her, I described to her exactly what was going on with my mind and what to do about it, because, you know, I have frankly wondered whether I should even continue to speak, you know, give talks here, because, you know, I find myself all over the place sometimes. But she said, look, this is entirely explicable because of the hormone therapy you're on. This particular drug is notorious for that. She's heard this story many, many times, which of course was greatly reassuring to me. But the reason I'm mentioning it is because yes, I find that I'm less able to give a coherent sort of talk, a sort of linear talk, if you like, where you go from one point to another point and there's a whole logical progression. Or you can see that there's sort of logic of the talk. I don't mean logic too strictly, but you can see how it all begins to make sense as a whole. So I thought what I'd do this evening is have a different approach. So it's going to be all over the place, frankly. Quite deliberately so, because it's going to help me to do what I want to do. I hope it'll be a way of communicating something to you of Amitabha's significance. So I'm not going to give you, what will be the word? Might see my vocabulary goes too. A sort of, this isn't the right way to put it, but a sort of standard description of Amitabha and all his associations. I'm going to leap around. I'm going to have a look at different aspects of the symbolism associated with him and try to make different connections. So that, if you like, what I hope to be able to do is to create a sort of pattern which will, by the end of the evening, make some sort of sense. So let's start at the beginning. Amitabha. Amitabha is the Buddha of infinite light. That's what his name means. Or infinite life in one form. And he is the Buddha of the Western direction. So if you've been coming along to previous classes, certainly towards the end of last year, I think it was, or maybe the beginning of this, I can't remember now, we were looking at the five Jina mandala. I think it was towards the end of last year. And the five Jina mandala is the five Buddha mandala. So Amitabha is one of the five Jinas. And this mandala, this kind of pattern, if you like, of Buddhas, symbolizes, represents the totality of the qualities of the enlightened. But they're sort of, each of the Buddhas has certain associations. Like I said, for example, that Amitabha is the Buddha of the West. So he is associated with the Western direction of the compass. And the way that the mandala is arranged visually is you have a Buddha at the top who's in the north, one in the east, one in the center, one in the south, which is below, and one to the west, to a certain side, which, well, that's the west. And that's where Amitabha sits. So each Buddha has is associated with a particular point of the compass. And each of the Buddhas has a different colour. And of course, there's all sorts of associations and significances to the colours that they have. And there's a number of other associations which I might bring in. But what I want to do this evening to start with is to focus on one that I didn't really go into the last time I spoke about Amitabha. And that is that, each of the Buddhas is associated with a particular animal. And in the case of Amitabha, that animal is the peacock. Now, in Indian mythology, the peacock is associated with thriving on poison. And part of the myth is that the poison that is eaten by the peacock is responsible for producing the beautiful colours of its feathers. So that's the myth. So Amitabha, the Buddha Amitabha, is associated with this. Now, there's, moving away from the peacock for a moment, there's one of the associations with each of these figures is, well, each figure has a kind of emblem. In the case of Amitabha, that emblem is the lotus. So Amitabha is the head of the lotus family. Because there's a whole range of different figures who are associated with each of the Buddhas. It can get very complicated. I'm not going to describe all of these figures to you. I wouldn't have time. But I do want to mention two of them because you will probably be, well, most of you, some of you at least will be familiar with them. So as head of the lotus family or the Padma family, he has all these other bodhisattvas who are associated with him. And two of them that you will have heard of probably are Avalokiteshvara, the great bodhisattva of compassion, and Padmasambhava, who's a figure of, he's very different from Avalokiteshvara. He's a sort of slightly wrathful figure, kind of midway between a wrathful form of a Buddha and a peaceful form. And he has a slightly wrathful smile, slightly threatening, which is very appealing to some of us. He's a figure which has held great fascination for many people in Sri Ratna over the years, even right from the very early days. So you have these two figures, and each of them, in their own way, are associated with the process of transformation, perhaps Padmasambhava more than any of the others, really. I think that he is a figure, he's the guru of transformation, radical transformation. But you have this association also with Avalokiteshvara in two ways. We'll get back to the peacock in a minute because it's connected. That is to do with the fact that, the very emblem of the lotus itself is a symbol, if you like, of transformation. Because the lotus plant has its roots deep down in the mud at the bottom of a pond, the lotus pond. And the plant draws all the nutrition from the mud and transforms them, you could say, eventually into a very, very beautiful flower. So you have these associations with the lotus. These associations, therefore, are part of Amitabha's myth or significance or whatever you would call it. But there's a link also with the peacock, because the peacock essentially is transforming poison into something beautiful, whatever that might mean. Now, going back to the lotus family and going back specifically to Avalokiteshvara, there's one form of Avalokiteshvara known as Nilakanta. And Nilakanta literally means blue-throated. This brings us back to Indian mythology again. The myth goes that when this universe was created, the gods and the Asherahs, kind of like Titanic gods, they churned the great ocean of samsara between them. It was quite a tussle between them, actually. But anyway, they churned this great ocean of samsara, and what was thrown up was all sorts of really, truly wonderful things. You know, the cow of plenty and all the usual bits and pieces you get with Indian mythology. The wish-granting tree and so on and so forth. So that all these wonderful things were created out of this chaos of the ocean, and this churning of the ocean. But one thing which was thrown up or churned up was not so beautiful. It was a huge pot of poison. And this poison was so powerful that it could destroy the whole of sentient existence. So something needed to be done about this. Enter Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara drinks all this poison. Perhaps only Avalokiteshvara can do that. He drinks all the poison. But it doesn't penetrate the whole of his body. It just sticks, as it were, in his throat and transforms it blue. Hence, Nilakanta, blue-throated Avalokiteshvara. So clearly Avalokiteshvara does this in a Buddhist context. I have to say that this myth has also been used in Hindu pantheon as well. But anyway, in Buddhism, this myth, this legend, this ancient Indian legend, is adopted in a very particular way. So what this represents is, I think it's an expression of Avalokiteshvara's compassion. Now his throat turns blue. The poison doesn't penetrate right down inside him into his stomach. If it did that, it would destroy him, apparently. So it's held, or it's left its mark in his throat. So he has this blue throat. So the blue-throated Avalokiteshvara is a fairly rare form, in fact, probably quite late in terms of the sort of Buddhist iconography. It's a tantric form. There are meditation practices where people visualize this form, but it was part of the Buddhist tantra. It was not part of the sort of mainstream. And you don't often see pictures of this figure. I tried to find one or two on the internet the other day. I managed to find three on the internet. They're a very, very thorough search. So Avalokiteshvara, in this instance, has this blue throat, and he sits, unusually for Avalokiteshvara, on a tiger skin. What all that means is, well, I'm just going to leave it with you. But there's a connection, because, of course, Nilakanta Avalokiteshvara is part of the Lotus family. He's got close associations with the figure of Amitabha. And Amitabha's animal is the peacock, that thrives on poison, transforms poison into something beautiful. So what does all this mean? How can we relate this to our own experience? Well, of course, in the course of our lives, perhaps not on retreat, but from time to time, certainly, we experience painful things. We might even experience painful things on a retreat. But we experience them on a retreat in a different way, because we're generally in a more positive emotional state than we might be in the normal sort of in our more normal daily activities at work and so forth. But the fact is, we encounter a lot of pain, a lot of even poison. Last week, I went to a sauna. Not in the habit of doing this, but I went to a sauna partly because my acupuncturist thinks it would be useful for me to detoxify. And Swan apparently is a very good way of doing that. I don't know whether these things work, but I'm willing to try anything. But not having an awful lot of money, the only sauna I could afford to go to was the one at Mile End Leisure Centre. £2 off peak, not bad. Affordable. I could have 6 saunas every week. I don't intend to, by the way. But anyway, I went to the sauna twice last week. And on the second occasion, I was sitting on the upper bench of this rather cramped sauna. And a rather large lady came in. And I can't remember whether she asked me or she told me to move my feet. I was kind of sitting like that, if you see what I mean. So I went like this, thinking that I'd done the trick. But she just scowled at me and went and sat somewhere else, not too far away. And then she looked at me again. And she said, "I told you to move your feet, I won't repeat what she said." It was pretty unpleasant. Just imagine the worst thing you can possibly be called. Well, I was called that by this lady. I laughed. I didn't intend to. I assure you I did not intend to, because if I'd done that deliberately, you would have been taken as a provocation. And that was the last thing I wanted to do. I didn't want to provoke anything. But it was just a sort of like a totally instinctive response. I laughed. And I immediately thought, God, no, I shouldn't be doing this. Anyway, she didn't make her too happy. But she didn't join in. But at least I didn't react. I could have done. I could have said, well, I did move my feet. I knew that would serve no useful purpose. That would probably lead to an argument. So I just sat quietly and sort of absorbed what had happened. And you know, when you're called something like what I was called, it's not very pleasant. Okay, it's only words. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but you know, words they cannot harm me or whatever. Well, that's not quite true. If you're on the receiving end of an intense negative emotion from somebody else, it's very, very painful. I'm sure you all know that. So how do you deal with this? Well, all I could do, I wish I hadn't laughed, actually, but I really couldn't have stopped myself. I was shocked. I think it was just, you know, sometimes when you're shocked, you sort of laugh, don't you, involuntarily. I think that's all that happened. But I just sat there very, very, very quietly, looking straight ahead and trying to, well, just be mindful, really. Hopefully that doesn't happen to any of you too frequently. I cannot remember anything like that happening to me for quite some time. But the only way you can deal with that when someone is, you know, behaving in some way or other negatively towards you is just try to not react. If you try to engage with them, probably it's not the best thing. You might provoke them into further anger or whatever. Not unless you're incredibly skillful in a way that I know that I am not. But I think what this teaching represents of the Bodhisattva drinking the poison. Well, first of all, I think it suggests that, for example, a Bodhisattva may encounter a lot of hostility. It's a point I might come back to, if I can remember it, in a moment. All the Bodhisattva, in a sense, can do is show us how to deal with how to deal with the poison when it comes our way. And I suppose, looking back at my recent life, I could say quite honestly that this is partly how I've dealt with the cancer. I just didn't react to it. I didn't sort of allow myself to get down. I knew I couldn't afford to let that happen. Just sat with it. And more than that, actually, I knew that I had to learn to welcome it. Some of you have heard me say this many times, but I think that's the sort of attitude that we have to bring to bear when something unpleasant, something that we don't want in life, comes to us. Whether it's someone behaving, you know, getting very angry with us, or whether it's something like a serious diagnosis that you have to face, of some other kind of unpleasantry, even coming off retreat and hearing about those terrible bombings in Sri Lanka. I think, it really was deeply shocking. What can you do? You know, in a sense, we're impotent in the sense that we can't do anything immediately to help the people who have suffered as a consequence of that. But at least we can try and just swallow the poison, if you like, not react, keep it in our throat, not let it penetrate the rest of our being. So that, I think, is what all this is about, what this peacock myth is about. So this is one of the very interesting associations with Amitabha from his animal, the peacock. Actually, there's a couple of stories that occur to me which are worth recounting in relation to this. Maybe more, actually. I might sort of stick with this for a while longer. There's a very famous story involving Hakuin in Japan. Hakuin was a famous Zen master. He was considered to be enlightened. And he stayed in a temple somewhere in Japan. And at one stage in his life, a young woman turned up at the temple with a very young boy. And she presented it to Hakuin, who was a very famous master at this time, and said to him, "This is your child." And he simply said, "Is that so?" He didn't say, "No, it's not, it's yours." You know, I want to have a gene test or something like that. He said, "No." He said, "Is that so?" And she didn't say anything, apparently. She just left the child with him. And for a number of years, he looked after the boy and brought him up inside the temple. Years later, the woman returned and she wanted her son back. And she confessed, she said, "Look, it's not your son. I told a lie. He's not your son. I want my son back." And his response on this occasion was, "Is that so?" And she took the boy away. So this is a perfect example, if you like, of someone kind of swallowing poison, because, you know, she was publicly humiliating Hakuin. And no doubt all sorts of rumours would have circulated as a consequence of what she had done. And his response, he didn't deny it. He just simply said, "Is that so?" And then looked after the child. To all intents and purposes, it looked as if, well, yes, it really was his son. But no, actually, someone had to look after the son. And he did. He did what was objectively necessary. But for anybody, enlightened or otherwise, that kind of experience surely is unpleasant. And there's another story connecting with this, which is this is a story about the Buddha, actually, that on one occasion, someone approached the Buddha, a Brahmin, as it happens. The Buddha wasn't very popular with the Brahmins because he wasn't in favour of the caste system. And that didn't make him particularly popular. Anyway, this Brahmin came to see him, as many Brahmins did in the course of his life. Some of them, of course, became his disciples, but not this one. And he wasn't very happy with the Buddha, and he made it quite clear, in no uncertain terms, why that was. And basically verbally abused him, I suppose. Eventually, of course, he exhausted everything he had to say. And there was a moment of silence. And the Buddha then spoke, having remained silent throughout the whole tirade, and said, "Is that all?" And the man said, "Yes, that's all. I don't think I have anything further to say." So the Buddha then asked him a question. He said, "Look, if someone gave you a gift that you did not want, to whom would that gift belong?" So the Brahmin said, "Well, where it would belong to the person who was trying to offer it to me. And so the Buddha said, yes. And he said, thank you for your gift, but it's yours, you can keep it. And the Brahmi left with his own gift. So, that's another example of dealing with this kind of poison that sometimes we come into contact with in the course of our lives. I mean, not, and perhaps sometimes we ourselves are guilty of spilling out a little bit of poison onto others. We mustn't completely let ourselves off the hook, myself included. But it's all indicative of how to deal with these very difficult situations, which from time to time we're inevitably going to find ourselves in. And finally, there's one other thing this brings to mind for me, which is that I don't know how much you know of the history of Triratna, but Sangharakshita, the founder of Triratna, when he first came back to this country after many, many years in India, he came back because he was invited to come back by the sort of leading Buddhists of the UK at that time. Not that the Buddhist movement was anything to boast about at that time. It was very, very tiny. Perhaps just really involving a handful of people. In 1964, when he returned, Buddhism really wasn't well known at all, hardly at all, in fact. Anyway, he was invited back to London by the president of the Buddhist Society and the chairman of the English Sangha Trust. And these were the two main rival Buddhist outfits in London, and they were at one another's throats, which is not a particularly Buddhist thing to be, activity, you see what I mean? But anyway, he was invited back as the senior most English Buddhist monk to help them try to resolve their difficulties. So he came back, and he stayed. He was going to come back for 6 months. Eventually, he ended up staying for 2 years. And he stayed at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, which was the premises of the English Sangha Trust. And he decided while he was here that he could see great potential for Buddhism in the West. He's going to come back to London and make his life here and help to establish Buddhism here in this country, certainly in London. But first of all, he needed to go back to India to sort of finalise his affairs there. And while he was away back in India, the people who were previously at one another's throats got together, and the president of the Buddhist Society, in conjunction with these other people, wrote to Bhante Sangharakshita saying, don't come back. It's no longer necessary for you to come back. No explanation given, apparently. Now, he was delighted. Not delighted because he was glad not to have to come back, but delighted because it meant he could come back on a different basis and establish what he felt was truly necessary, a new Buddhist movement, which is the Triratna that you know today, and London Buddhist Center is just one center of the Triratna community. So again, you have someone not reacting. I'm sure it was quite painful for him to receive that letter. I don't doubt it, actually. It must have been. But on the other hand, you could see that there's a wonderful opportunity presented as well. And so I think that's another key for us. When we encounter these difficult things in life, there's usually an opportunity for us. That's certainly been the case for me with the cancer. I don't regret having had the cancer. I'm not cured. I mean, I've still got cancer. I don't regret it at all, because it's really sort of helped me to grow. It's really helped me to change for the better. And we all need instances of that in our lives. Hopefully not the serious cancer diagnoses, but we need from time to time something like that which sort of challenges us. We can seek out those challenges, but actually life itself is just full of them. You don't have to do that. Seeking them out, if you're of the heroic spirit, is certainly an honourable thing to do. But life itself usually brings these things to us, in time at least, as I have certainly found out. Okay, so I think this is all this is related to this symbolism of the peacock, Amitabha's animal. So maybe I should jump around a bit further and see what else I can talk about. Perhaps I can link something else into what I've just been talking about, but I want to come back to it. Amitabha is the Buddha of the West, the Buddha of the Western direction. And of course, we live in the Western direction. We are, you know, I mean, this is, we live in the West, the modern West. And there is, well, that it is said that there's a prophecy by Padmasambhava, who is part of the Padma family, part of the Lotus family, therefore associated with Amitabha. Padmasambhava apparently prophesied that when iron birds fly in the sky, my teachings will go to the West. Now, of course, this might have been manufactured recently by some witty lama, but anyway, the tradition is that this was one of Padmasambhava's prophecies. I like to believe in the prophecy myself. I like to believe in the myth. But anyway, certainly there are iron birds flying in our sky, and Buddhism has come to the West. And not only that, well, the Buddha here that you see before you is an image of Amitabha, the Buddha of the West. Quite deliberately, we chose, or Sangharakshita chose, to have an image of Amitabha in this room. Because when the whole project that became the London Buddhist Centre was under process, this was going to be our principal centre, certainly in London. You know, kind of like the sort of like, how did he put it? Sort of like he actually described it as the flagship of the FWBO. We used to be known as the FWBO, but he clearly, it was a very, very special place for him to have this centre here. And so he wanted an image of Amitabha as the Buddha of the West. And he named this building Sukhavati. Now, Sukhavati is the pure land of Amitabha. Sukhavati means the happy land or the land of bliss. And if you know anything about Chinese or Japanese Buddhism, the devotees of Amitabha, known in Japan as Amida, all hope or pray to be reborn in Sukhavati, the happy land, Amitabha's paradise, the paradise in the West, the Western paradise. So this building is imbued with that kind of symbolism, if you like. The two communities, well, sorry, there are two communities above this building. Originally, there was just one, and it's quite a large men's community. There are now two. But that community was called Sukhavati. But the whole building is actually called Sukhavati. The community that I live in upstairs is called Sukhavati. So we have these associations with the London Buddhist Centre as well. And there's another sort of connection with this, which is that, for us, which is that many, many years ago, when Sangharakshita, before he actually became a Buddhist monk, when he's still wandering around in India as a mendicant, he had a vision in a cave, and he had a vision while meditating. And he's described this vision very vividly in the first volume of his memoirs. And it was a vision of Amitabha. But it was a very unique vision. It was different from the sort of normal iconographic forms of Amitabha. But he knew that it was Amitabha. I might, if I've got time, read the description of that before I finish. There is this sort of connection for us with this whole mythology surrounding Amitabha. Now, I think it's quite interesting that Amitabha's wisdom, to jump off slightly at another tangent, but we'll try and bring it back to what I'm really trying to get across. In Amitabha's wisdom, because each of the five Buddhas is associated with a particular wisdom, is the wisdom, the all-distinguishing wisdom, or the discriminating wisdom. And what one of the significances of this is that Amitabha is able to see things in their unique particularity, so that Well, you know, the universe is full of phenomena, including other beings, living beings, human beings. Everyone, every single one is different. Everyone is unique. And Amitabha's wisdom sees that uniqueness. So that, well, just even thinking in terms of humanity, every human being is different. No two even look alike. Well, you might get identical twins, but they, in my observation, they don't always look that alike. You can see differences even in identical twins. They're all different. Every human being is different. Every human being has been conditioned by very particular and unique factors. Every human being has particular qualities or virtues, and they're a particular combination of vices. We all look different from one another. You'll never see anybody else in this room that looks like me. I won't see anyone else in this room that looks like any of you, and so on. We all look different. We all are different. Amitabha sees the unique particularity, the individuality of each living being. And as it happens, one of the more innovative ways of presenting the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching in the West, by Sangharakshita, is that he's described it, he's described it in terms of human development, in terms of the development of individuality, of true individuality. Because in the West, the idea of being an individual is very important. We all like to think of ourselves as individuals. We're quite unique. I remember on one occasion when I was in Manchester, I was teaching at the Manchester Buddhist Centre at the time, and it was back in the punk days, and I wasn't a punk. Anyway, these two punks turned up. They weren't looking for the Manchester Buddhist Centre as it happened. They just rang the doorbell, and I answered. And I was a little bit taken aback. For me, they looked very strange. Anyway, I got talking to them and asked them, why do you have such strange haircuts? And some kind of Mohican cut, which was dyed blue or pink or something, I can't remember. I said, oh, we're all individuals. But it's not that sort of thing that we mean by the development of individuality. Sangharakshita meant something quite different from that. And he actually specified all sorts of qualities which he associates with the development of individuality. Actually, they all have their roots in Buddhist tradition, and they're all simply different ways of looking at the sort of virtues you'd expect to develop as a Buddhist anyway. But he put a particular sort of... He looked at this whole question of individuality from a Dharmic perspective and described the qualities that we're all trying to develop in his own particular way. For example, he spoke of the true individual as ethical, as characterized by positive emotion, as responsible. Responsible in the sense of being able to take responsibility for others, in a certain sense. That shouldn't be taken too literally. But he enumerated a whole list of these qualities. But he also gave a very interesting lecture on one occasion where he sort of gave examples in Western culture or Western history of people who he would identify as embodying in greater and lesser degrees what he considered to be the qualities of the true individual. And he also mentioned that very often one of the characteristics, it's quite the right term, it may not be, but one of the features of a true individual, looking back over history, was very often that they were unpopular. And they were unpopular because they, presumably, were people, men and women, who knew their own minds and were not, would not simply be swayed by the, let's say, what would be the word, the sort of the consensus of the conventions of the society in which they lived. So unpopularity. Again, for me, this links in with the idea of the peacock eating poison. And I think of Bhante when he came back to the West to establish the FWBO. And I think anyone who is prominent in any sphere of life is likely to have to eat poison. Right, so that's the Western direction that Amitabha is associated with. I think I'm going to leave it there. There's quite a bit. There's quite a lot else I could have said this evening, but I just want to leave space for one or two questions, and then we're going to conclude with a little bit of mantra recitation and meditation so that you can go off in a quieter mood after the talk. So does anybody have any questions about anything I've said so far? Yeah?
Are there any circumstances where you think it is appropriate to defend oneself against abuse?
Well, it depends how you defend yourself. I mean, for instance, I told you that story about myself in the sauna. I was defending myself by not engaging. If I'd said, I did move my feet, it would have just led to an argument. She wasn't in the mood to listen to what I had to say, I think. So that's how I defended myself in that situation. Of course, there are situations when you should defend yourself. But there are ways and means of doing that. But I think the key thing is not to react. I didn't react on that occasion. I just okay. It's got nothing to do with me in a way. A bit like the Buddha. The Buddha didn't really defend himself, but I mean, he kind of made it difficult for the man who left, in a very positive kind of way. So I don't know. Does that sort of satisfy you? So it's one way of looking at it, anyway. I mean, maybe it sounds like it doesn't satisfy everyone. I can tell, but certainly that's one thing you can do. Of course, it depends what you're defending yourself against as well. I mean, for example, to use this the most extreme example. Because sometimes you get asked this kind of question in a beginner's class, when you're talking about the principle of non-violence to people who are not familiar with it. What do you do if someone's pointing a gun at your head and trying to kill you in some way? Do you let them do that or not? I think if someone was trying to kill me, I'd fight like hell. But that's partly to do with my temperament. I certainly wouldn't, I wouldn't just let them kill me. That might be an irresponsible thing in itself. So I don't know. I mean, I think in extreme circumstances, you never quite know how you're going to react, do you? Sometimes you surprise yourself. I mean, when I was diagnosed with cancer, I surprised myself by my own response to it, which was actually very positive. And I would never have expected that in the abstract beforehand. So if someone was pointing a gun at myself, I don't know what at me. I don't know what I'd do, but I suspect I wouldn't just try and let them get away with it if I could stop it. Why should I? Why should anyone? You've got to work it out for yourself, really. I mean, I think that the key thing with Buddhist ethics is to remember that the fundamental principle is that of non-harming. But that doesn't mean to say that you should let others harm you without good reason. Never really. I mean, if you can avoid that, do. By not getting engaged with that woman in the sauna, I was protecting myself against her. And she left me alone. I mean, if I'd started talking to her, it might have turned into a terrible argument. I don't know. Yeah.
So, if you do in that moment, if you do kind of don't react, and with that pain, if you just kind of like let it sit and scrub in your throat, does it lead to like a build up of energy? How do you let it move through your body? Like, for example, if a painful thing arises in your life, and the idea of like ruminating on it later, does that make sense? How do you
deal with that?
Well, again, you
try not to do it, of course, but I think the bigger project is to develop metta, to develop positive emotion as much as you can. So that whatever difficult situation you find yourself in, if you're responding, well, if you're responding with metta, at least if you're not responding back with some kind of negative response, that will help you to deal with it, and you'll be less likely to be prone to rumination. But I think if you don't have much metta, it'd be much more difficult to do that, because your negative emotions will be triggered. And however you respond in the situation, if you don't feel happy with your own behaviour at the time, you might ruminate on it. But I think if things like that, it's best not to dwell upon them. I mean, I didn't dwell upon that incident in the sauna. I remembered it because I thought, oh, that's a good story to tell. And it was recent in my life. I'm not sure that I've really answered your question, have I?
Yeah, no,
you
did.
I have, okay. Yeah, this is going to be the last question, by the way.
This is the same question, really, but it's just about if you have this tendency to suck it up.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it might. I mean, a positive response might involve doing that, but I think also something I didn't say, which I should have said, but I can say now, thanks to your question, is that I think sometimes we've got to be very careful about the influences that we expose ourselves to. Sometimes we can't avoid it because of our work situations, but if you know, for example, that certain people are just kind of too provoking for you, well, try to keep out of their way. I mean, it's difficult if it's a family member, and quite often it is, try to, you know, sometimes you just have to think, oh God, I just can't deal with this, I'm going to avoid that person or whatever. You've got to find the best strategy for dealing with it, yeah? It's not straightforward and easy. Anyway, as I said, I'd like to finish with something a bit more meditative. So I'm going to read you the account.